Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. Congress returns to Washington today for a short pre-election session that most likely will not include action on the looming deadline for the Budget Control Act of 2011. Without action, without a compromise, the Budget Control Act calls for $1.2 trillion in across-the-board spending cuts beginning in January. Big part of the equation is Medicare, of course. Joining us now to talk about that and more is Alice Rivlin. She's the founding director of the Congressional Budget Office, serving through three administrations, and former chairwoman, vice chairwoman of the Federal Reserve under Alan Greenspan. She also was appointed by President Obama to the Simpson-Bowles Commission on Fiscal Reform, and she co-chaired with former Senator Pete Domenici the Debt Reduction Task Force of the Bipartisan Policy Center. She's speaking today on the OSU campus at the Barbara K. Fergus Women in Leadership Lecture presented by OSU's John Glenn School of Public Policy. For more information, go to our website at WOSU.org/allsides. We'll have a link there for you. The event is free, but you do have to pre-register. So go to WOSU.org/allsides if you're interested in that. Welcome to the show, Alice Rivlin.
Oh, delighted to be here.
Last week, President Obama, in a campaign speech, referenced one of his predecessors, former President Bill Clinton.
I'm still eager to reach an agreement based on the principles of my bipartisan debt commission. No party has a monopoly on wisdom. No democracy works without compromise. But when Governor Romney and his friends in Congress tell us we can somehow lower our deficits by spending trillions more on new tax breaks for the wealthy, well, what Bill Flynn call it? You do the arithmetic.
So, Alice Rivlin, there's lots of bandying about that phrase, you do the arithmetic. It seems simple, but it can't be simpler. Wouldn't we have done it already?
Absolutely. We're in a very difficult situation. And right now we've got two things looming at us, the so-called fiscal cliff immediately, the thing you described in your opening, where if we don't do something before the end of the year, we will have big automatic spending cuts across the board, rather mindless ones, and a big tax increase. Now, nobody wants that to happen. It wouldn't be good for the economy right now at all. It would derail this fragile recovery. But the really even more serious problem is the long run. We have all of these seniors, and I'm one of them, retiring and moving into the age in which so many people are eligible for Medicare and Medicaid and Social Security. And as we look ahead, the federal spending for those programs will rise faster than revenues. So we got to do something about it. And I think that the arithmetic dictates that we do both reform of entitlement programs so they aren't growing as fast over the long run, and a tax reform that'll generate more revenue.
You've written about the current debate, or lack thereof, I guess, over Medicare. You've noted that although both sides agree on the projections, they disagree on the approach. Democrats mistrusting the private sector, Republicans mistrusting government. You suggest that both approaches together would work, or at least are worth trying.
Oh, absolutely. I think what's going on in the campaign right now is very unfortunate because both sides are scaring seniors. Both sides are saying the other side is going to cut your Medicare. The Democrats, and I'm a Democrat, I think just as guilty as the Republicans on this score. Nobody wants to do away with Medicare, and nobody wants to punish seniors. We need a Medicare program that takes care of the health of seniors, and we're going to have more and more of them, of us,
and not necessarily healthier seniors, all things being equal. A lot of them won't necessarily have a lot of money, and that's where people are concerned about the voucher proposal put forth by Congressman Paul Ryan.
Well, yes, but I think they're over-concerned. The first proposal put forward in his original roadmap, as he called it, by Paul Ryan, was very stingy. And it would have reduced spending on Medicare over time by unacceptable amounts. And I thought it was not a good idea. But the basic idea of using competition among private plans as well as improving traditional Medicare, can give you a compromise that gets where everybody wants to go. What everybody wants to do is preserve the Medicare program, make sure it's there for future seniors, and make it more efficient so that we aren't doing as wasteful things. The current situation is in American healthcare generally is pretty wasteful.
My guest is Alice Rivlin, founding director of the Congressional Budget Office, former vice chairwoman of the Federal Reserve, and much more. If you have a question or comment for Alice Rivlin, give us a call, 614-292-8513. You can email us at allsides@wosu.org. You can also go to our Facebook page and post your question or comment there, or tweet us at WOSU All Sides. The way you described Medicare there for a second sounded a lot like the way some people describe Obamacare or the health care reform law. Are they so different in outlook in terms of the idea of keeping that competition intact, but also giving people a fallback position if they can't afford it?
Yes, I think they're not so different, that we need to do both. We need to preserve traditional Medicare as an option for everybody permanently. But we also need to offer seniors a choice of private plans on an exchange. Now, exchanges were an idea which came into the Affordable Care Act, or Obamacare, as the Republicans like to call it. They're a good idea that was done in the Romney plan in Massachusetts, that people who didn't have insurance could go to an exchange online, see what was available to them, and if they didn't have enough income, get a subsidy to buy it. That idea is definitely in the Affordable Care Act, and Democrats have supported it there. It also is already in Medicare, because we do have Medicare Advantage, which was very badly designed when it was first put forward, but has been greatly improved and does allow seniors to choose a private plan and use their Medicare there. So if we could get those private plans competing in a more visible way, in a way that would allow seniors to choose the one that's best for them, and on the basis of information about what actually happens to people in those plans, that would be a supplement to a traditional Medicare. And I think that a good compromise.
614-292-8513 is the number to call. Alex in Columbus, you're on the air. Welcome to the show.
Thanks for taking my call. I just wanted to disagree with the idea that everyone wants to save Medicare. If you look at Paul Ryan's original budget from a couple of years ago, and if you look at the Republican Party platform from the convention just last week, they both call for turning Medicare into a voucher program with Medicare as it currently exists as a public option. And I would like to say that there is a significant difference between actually having insurance, which is what Medicare currently provides, and a voucher to purchase insurance, which is indexed not to the increase in the cost of healthcare, but rather to inflation, which has been about, I think, less than half the current growth of healthcare costs.
Alice Rivlin?
The caller is absolutely right about the original Ryan plan. As I said earlier, totally unacceptable, much too stingy, only indexed at the rate of inflation. The more recent Ryan-Wyden plan, and Wyden is a Democrat, is very similar to what Senator Pete Domenici and I are proposing. And it would be indexed. It would have the federal contribution determined by a bidding process, which means it is determined by the cost of health care, but capped at the rate of growth of the economy, of the GDP, plus 1%. That's a much more generous rate. Now, the question is, suppose health care costs go up faster than that, what do you do? You could do several things. You could have a means-tested premium for upper-income seniors. You could take it out of provider payments, or you could simply increase the subsidy. The Congress would have to decide, if that happened, what to do.
Alex, thanks for your call. Take care. Bill in Springfield, you're on the air. Welcome to the show, Bill.
Hi, thanks for having my call. I just had a suggestion, and I wanted to run it by you. What would happen if we tied the corporate tax rate to the unemployment rate? It's like the grain compromise, right? Corporations would get low tax rates. Everybody would get a job. How would that work?
I'm not sure how that would work. I think you need a stable corporate tax rate. Ours has been a top rate of around 35%, which is rather high relative to other countries. If we reform the corporate tax so that we're many fewer loopholes and special provisions, we could bring the rate down. But tying it to the unemployment rate, first place, the unemployment rate where? In Ohio, in California? I'm not sure how you do that or exactly what the point would be. We need to get the unemployment rate down, but I'm not taken by the idea of tying it to the corporate tax rate.
Thanks a lot, Bill.
The corporation's best interest. Okay, thanks.
Okay. We were talking earlier about President Clinton's reference to arithmetic, and I was wondering if you could compare the political climate during the Clinton administration when they had the four budgets that were balanced and had actually surplus to work with, a few cents here and there. But what was the political climate then, and how did it differ from what we have now, and could it ever be replicated?
I'm glad you brought that up because I'm very proud of that era. I was the budget director for part of the several years in the first Clinton administration when we did move from a very considerable deficit. We forget how bad it was then to a surplus. We weren't actually aiming for a surplus. We were just aiming to balance the budget. And the economy was so good in that period that we overshot. We got a very considerable surplus for several years, which disappeared after the end of the Clinton administration. What happened in that year, in that period, was a combination of good policy, I think. Restraint in government spending. We had rules in the Congress then, the so-called PAYGO rules and caps on discretionary spending. The PAYGO rules said you can't pass a new entitlement program unless you pay for it with reducing something else, or you can't pass a tax cut unless you pay for it by doing something else that offsets it. And that was what kept the budget spending from growing in that period, kept taxes from being cut too. But the good, and with a good economy and the sort of dot-com high-tech boom of the end of the 90s, which did end in a stock market crash, but that's how we got there.
What happened to the pay-as-you-go rules?
They lapsed at the end of...
And it's a congressional issue, right?
Yes, it was a congressional issue. And the actual first Bush tax cut was okay within the PAYGO rules because we had such a big surplus at that moment. But the second one wasn't. And the Medicare drug Part D wouldn't have been possible under the old PAYGO rules. So we dug ourselves a pretty big hole in there because we allowed the rules to lapse. Now, that wasn't the only reason that the deficits turned into surplus. The surpluses turned into deficits. We also had a recession. We had two wars. But all of that is history, and now we need to look forward. It's really, how are we going to fund the retirement of the baby boom generation looking forward? It has nothing to do with that past history. And how are we going to pay those bills?
Once again, my guest is Alice Rivlin, former budget director for the Clinton administration, as she mentioned, founding director of the Congressional Budget Office, and former vice chairwoman of the Federal Reserve. If you have a question or comment for her, give us a call, 614-292-8513. You can email us at allsides@wosu.org. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
Five years after the bubble burst, finally some good news on housing. Prices and sales are up. Dave Main builds homes in and around Seattle.
We are seeing people being able to borrow money from banks. Interest rates are low and prices are still reasonable.
But not everywhere. I'm Neil Conan, Robert Schiller on the housing rebound. Next Talk of the Nation from NPR News.
Talk of the Nation this afternoon from 2 to 4. 69 degrees with sunshine warming up to 74 today. Clear skies tonight, a low of 50 degrees. Support for 89.7 comes from Home Instead Senior Care, offering online educational programs for the community. Information about Alzheimer's and assistance in managing loved ones' difficult behaviors can be found at helpforalzheimersfamilies.com or by calling 486-6643. And All Sides continues here on 89.7 NPR News.
My guest is Alice Rivlin, founding director of the Congressional Budget Office, former vice chairwoman of the Federal Reserve, former budget director for the Clinton administration. If you have a question or comment for Alice, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu. Alice is speaking today on the OSU campus at the Barbara K. Fergus Women in Leadership Lecture presented by OSU's John Glenn School of Public Policy. For more information, go to our website at wosu.org/allsides, and we'll have a link there for you. It is a free event, but you do have to pre-register if you're interested. It's later on today. If you want to give us a call, once again, 614-292-8513. I wanted to talk just briefly about the idea that everything hasn't been fixed in 4 years. And I know that you're a Democrat. You mentioned that earlier. But can anything as bad as it was get fixed in 4 years when it comes to an economy as complex as the United States? And it comes across as apologizing for the president. And likewise, does it mean that you're blaming the Republicans who went before him for it?
I don't think it has to mean that. And I agree with you that the expectation that people had in 2008 that somehow a new president could change everything was unrealistic. Even President Obama did not know at the time he was campaigning, neither did Senator McCain, how bad things were getting even as they were out there campaigning. The financial crash of September 2008 was an unprecedented event that threw us into a deep recession, and the economy was in free fall as the president was taking over and getting worse by the minute. We were losing jobs by the millions, and the situation had to be stabilized. It did get stabilized. It did turn from freefall disaster into moderate recovery. That's a considerable achievement, but we're not there yet. And the fact that the recovery has been slow seems to me not surprising given the magnitude of the catastrophe, and particularly the fact that the housing market melted down in such a disastrous way, and so many people are underwater on their mortgages. So a slow recovery is not surprising. But when Obama says, I inherited a mess, it's interpreted as blaming the Republicans. I don't think it should be. The blame for the meltdown in 2008 goes way back. I mean, there were things that we should have done in the Clinton administration. There were things that should have been done in the private sector and in various regulatory agencies to avoid all of that, and they weren't done. There's plenty of blame to go around. But there the administration was in January of 2009 with a terrible catastrophe on their hands, and that they haven't fixed everything in 3.5 years does not surprise me.
Was there ever a time in American history that you could say within 4 years you could fix something like that? Or has the American economy really gotten much more complicated in the last 50 years and it does make a difference?
Well, it depends. It certainly is more complicated and more subject to being battered from the outside than we used to be. One of the reasons that our economy is not growing faster right now is the mess in Europe. We are suffering from the fact that the Europeans haven't handled their situation very well, and they aren't buying as much from us as they were. And then that ricochets around. They aren't buying as much from the Chinese, and the Chinese aren't buying as much from us, and so forth. But it's a very complicated situation. But the only comparable thing, I think, is to go back to the beginning of the Depression. Now, that was worse. 25% unemployment, and Roosevelt came in with an unmitigated disaster on his hands. The banks were closing, all of that stuff. We didn't have that this time. But Roosevelt didn't get us out of that. He's fondly remembered, especially by Democrats, but he didn't get us out of it in 4 years or even eight. Now I think our economy is actually on a reasonably good track, but we need to keep going and create more jobs and get through the European problem.
Bill in Clinton Township, you're on the air. Welcome to the show, Bill.
Well, good morning, Ann. I called to, ask some basic questions. Regarding the debt and the deficit at the federal level, it's always been a mystery to me why it works this way, but I'm sure your guests can at least explain the way it works. During the Clinton years, there were some surpluses mentioned earlier, but at no time, during no fiscal year, did the debt ever stop growing. Could you? And that's sort of the first question. Second relates to Social Security, but I'd like to get a little bit of background information out there so we can understand why the debt and the deficit aren't necessarily the same. The annual debt growth and the deficit are not the same thing.
Okay. Thank you, Bill.
Yes, that's a little mystifying, but actually there is an answer. There are two kinds of debt that the federal government owes. Debt held by the public, and the public includes banks and businesses and everybody else who holds government debt, and half of those people are foreigners at the moment. That's one kind of debt, and that did go down in the surplus years of the late 90s. But the other calculation is the total debt, which includes the debt of the government to the trust funds, particularly the Social Security Trust Fund. And Social Security, when it runs a surplus, and it was at that time, invests that surplus in government bonds. And if you count those as government debt, and for some purposes you should, then it continued to grow through that period. But the debt held by the public went down.
Thanks a lot, Bill, for that call. We appreciate it. Take care. James in Columbus, you're on the air. Welcome to the show. Oops. I guess James isn't there. Okay. All right. We'll move on. If you have a question or comment for my guest, Alice Rivlin, founding director of the Congressional Budget Office, former vice chairwoman of the Federal Reserve, former budget director for the Clinton administration, you can give us a call, 614-292-8513. or email us at allsides@wosu.org, or check out the Facebook page and post your question or comment there. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. The fiscal cliff, the precipice that we're on now, the point's been made that it doesn't matter how much we cut. If you cut the point's been made by people who support the sequestration and just doing across the board cuts, that it won't hurt us. It'll help us help the larger economy by, you know, lowering our deficit and getting things, the budget, in order. Is there that bright line between government and private industry when it comes to jobs and how the spending affects jobs? Would it not hurt, or will it hurt us in the larger economy?
Well, people have different views about how many government services they think they want, and how what the government ought to be doing. But I don't think there's much dispute about the fact that if you cut government spending drastically, especially when you're in a recovery period with rather weak growth, that you will damage the growth. Fewer people will have jobs. And that's not very much in dispute among economists. And I'm amused that I think it isn't really very much in dispute among politicians, because many Republicans say government spending kills jobs. But if you say, do you mean defense spending? They say, oh, no, no, that creates jobs. It's this domestic spending that kills jobs. I've never understood how domestic spending, or any kind of government spending,
like on bridges and highways?
Yeah, the bridges, highways, or even take food stamps, for instance. I mean, people spend that in grocery stores, and grocery stores sell stuff and create jobs. So I don't understand how you can make that point. But it is a different point to say maybe the government should be doing less over time. That's a perfectly good philosophical position. But the idea that if you cut spending right now across the board, and this sequestration would hit defense very hard, as well as domestic spending, not the Medicare and Medicaid, actually, which were exempted. But if you did that, it would be bad for the economy. And similarly, on the other side, if you raise taxes quickly across the board on everybody, then people have less money to spend, and that destroys jobs. And I don't think anybody has disagreed with that. We put ourselves in a box. Deliberately, the Congress did this. They enacted a law that said, if we don't find a solution to this problem, we'll do something that nobody wants to do. That is, let these tax cuts all expire and do this drastic across-the-board spending cut. Nobody wants that to happen. Nobody thinks it's a good idea. It was put there to force them to come to grips with the real problem.
Right. This Congressional Super Committee did not reach an agreement.
Right.
On reducing the nation's ballooning debt, and you've said that they failed even to reach their minimum obligation. What was the minimum obligation?
Oh, the minimum obligation was stated in terms of, I think, $1.5 trillion over 10 years. They didn't even get to that. And we need, if you do these arithmetic over 10 years, we need $4 to $5 trillion reduction in either spending over 10 years, not right now, or revenue increase. And in my opinion, the arithmetic drives us to some of each. We've got to reduce the growth of the spending, especially on the health care entitlements, because those are the ones growing fastest. And we need more revenue, and we can get it from a better tax system.
And a growing economy.
And a growing economy.
Right. Pat. In Newcastle, Pennsylvania. Welcome to the show, Pat.
Hi. I just have a quick question. I'd like to know how much the tax cuts from 2000 until now that we have borrowed, and how much we're paying in interest. How much is it costing us?
The tax cuts from 2000, which were both the Bush cuts and additional tax cuts in the Obama administration. I don't have an exact number on that, but it contributes several trillion, if you're counting forward over 10 years, to the deficit.
Several trillion.
Yes. You know, these numbers are all big, but the real point is our spending is likely or certain really to go up faster than the economy can grow, and our revenues won't go up faster than the economy can grow. So we're going to need more revenue in addition to reducing the spending. We've got to do both. It isn't an either or.
The tax cuts, and Pat, thanks for your call.
Thank you.
The tax cuts, the idea of the tax cut, as you mentioned earlier, is the idea you put more money in the hands of the people who spend it and also people who of means and the 1%, if you want, you know, create jobs with that money. Do we know, has anyone ever figured out how many jobs were created by the tax cuts since 2000? Is there any way to, you know, come to any conclusions about that, if that's the point of them?
Well, the point of the tax cuts in 2001, the original Bush tax cuts, were not actually sold that way. Mm-hmm. If you remember what Bush said when he was campaigning in 2000, he said, we've got a surplus and we want to return it to the people. It's your money. And that's what I want to do with this surplus. Other people said, Bill Clinton was saying, save Social Security first or spend it on invested in roads and bridges or whatever. But the Bush position was we need to lower taxes. Now, we did have a recession in 2001, and the fact that we were cutting taxes did create some jobs. It made that recession less bad than it would have been. And it wasn't that bad. But over the long run, we have to pay for the government services we want. The thing that destroys jobs in the long run is having a growing debt, which will raise our interest rates and make it impossible for us to grow the economy. That is just as serious, in the long run, more serious as a job reduction problem than the recession now.
Lou in Cincinnati, you're on the air with Alice Rivlin. Welcome to the show, Lou.
Good morning, ladies. How are you?
Fine, thank you.
Awesome. I want to know, how does the proposed majority Congress budget affect Medicaid, Medicare versus the current administration's plan?
By the majority Congress budget, you mean the House passed budget, because we actually haven't had a congressional budget in quite a long time. That's one of our problems.
Well, yeah.
But the Republican-dominated House did pass a budget resolution. It isn't actually a budget. It would reduce spending relative to what the president has proposed very considerably, especially discretionary that is the appropriations every year for domestic programs, and that is its biggest difference, and it would reduce the long run growth of Medicare and Social Security, I think, by about the same amount that the president's budget would. The big difference is lower discretionary domestic spending, much lower, taking us back before the Great Society, and lower taxes.
Lou, thanks for your call. Take care. Well, we have to say goodbye to Alice Rivlin. Thanks for joining us today.
I enjoyed it. Great to be back in Ohio.
Alice will be speaking later today at the OSU campus at the Barbara K. Fergus Women in Leadership Lecture presented by OSU's John Glenn School of Public Policy. It's a free event, but you do have to pre-register. For more information, you can go to the link we'll have at our website at WOSU.org/allsides. Coming up, we're going to get a little bit more detail about the sequestration potential coming up in January. Stay with us. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
Actor Andrew Rannells originated the role of Elder Price in the Broadway musical The Book of Mormon, and he played Elijah, Hannah's former boyfriend, in HBO's Girls. Now he's co-starring in the new sitcom The New Normal, created by Ryan Murphy, who also created Glee. Andrew Rannells on the next Fresh Air. Join us.
And a Mormon just believes.
And Fresh Air begins in 20 minutes. It starts at noon on 89.7 NPR News. And sunshine today, a high of 74. Clear skies tonight, a low of 50 degrees. Sunny and a high of 80 on Tuesday. And your annual support of 89.7 NPR News is our largest source of income. Your gifts make up the funds we use to pay for the news you listen to every day. Remember that it's easy to renew your membership. Just visit WOSU.org/renew. And thank you for renewing your membership with 89.7 NPR News. And support for 89.7 comes from the Wexner Center for the Arts, presenting Palissimo, an adventurous dance theater company from New York and Wexner Center Residency Award recipient. Palissimo will be performing their Painted Bird Trilogy September 12th through the 16th. Details at wexarts.org. All Sides continues here on 89.7 NPR News.
We're talking about the national debt crisis, what to do about it. Money is always a big political issue, and the major party candidates have taken it and run with it once again.
They have no answer to this simple reality. We need to stop spending money we don't have.
Wisconsin Congressman and now GOP vice presidential nominee Paul Ryan is the House budget director. He's endorsed the so-called sequestration provision of the Budget Control Act of 2011. When Congress returns to Washington today for a short pre-election session, lawmakers likely will not take action on the looming sequestration deadline. And without a compromise, the Budget Control Act calls for $1.2 trillion in across-the-board spending cuts beginning in January. Joining us now to talk about that is Scott Lilly with the Center for American Progress. It's a nonpartisan institute focused on national policies for economic growth, the federal budget, and health care, and more. He worked for the United States Congress for 31 years, including the post of clerk and staff director of the House Appropriations Committee, and also minority staff director of that committee, and as executive director of the House Democratic Study Group. Welcome to the show, Scott Lilly.
Good to be with you.
So why do we call it sequestration, and how did this provision wind up in the Budget Control Act?
Well, I've wondered for a long time where this word sequestration came from. It goes back to the Graham Rudman Hollings balanced budget amendment in the mid-80s. I think 1986 was when it first reared its head. But it, you know, it basically just means across the board cuts, and the cuts that were envisaged in the earlier version, the Graham Rudman's Hollings version, were minuscule compared to the cut that we're facing now, which is a result of concessions that the president had to make in order to get the debt limit through Congress a year ago this past summer.
How did they come up with that number, with the percentage, the across-the-board cut that's called for in the bill? Was that negotiated as well?
Yes. They worked back from they wanted to make $1.2 trillion in savings. That was the number that the Tea Party members of the House Republican Conference had insisted on in order to agree to increase the debt limit. And when all of the negotiations that lasted, you know, I mean, they went on for like 2 months, and this was the last of about 10 plans that was presented, and it was at the final moment when the government was going to go into default, and they finally said yes to this. So that the good thing about sequestration is it kept us from default. The bad thing is it's absolutely horrific legislation from almost any standpoint of good government or wise use of tax dollars.
How much more time does Congress have to act? Do they have to do something by the end of the year? In other words, will it be a lame duck situation, or can they still do something at the beginning of the next session?
Well, yes. I mean, the truth is that the effects of this policy are already starting to take hold.
How so?
You have government contractors. We spend about $500 billion a year, the federal government does, on various contracts, mostly in defense, but really all over the government. And those contractors are already starting to slow hiring. They're starting to hold back in terms of buying plant and equipment that they might use for future contracts. And so we're seeing an economic effect there. We're also seeing in some programs like the Impact Aid program that helps school districts that are next to military installations or Indian reservations. They're funded for the current school year, and the superintendents of those schools are for the most part saying, we don't think there's a very good chance that we're going to get this money, so we're not going to hire the teachers and the reading experts and so forth that we had last year in anticipation that we're not going to get this money for the current year. So you're really seeing this ripple through the economy well ahead of this January deadline when it's supposed to click in.
So can Congress act at the beginning of the year, or do they have to act before the end of this?
Yeah, they can. You know, I mean, they can reverse this
whenever
at any
they want.
Point in time. Mm-hmm. The question is how much dislocation do you have before that takes place, and in some areas, particularly parts of the government programs that are almost all salaries of the people that are employed, for instance. One example would be the FBI or the Border Control and Customs, or the one that I've written a couple of articles on is the FAA. And the way this is written, the agencies have very little discretion in how they apply this cut. And the only way the FAA could do this would be to eliminate somewhere between 1,800 and 2,000 air traffic controllers. And so, you know, there's some really ugly choices in terms of how that implementation would go. In my judgment is that probably the easiest thing would be to shut down 90 to 100 of the smaller airports that the FAA has towers at. But that would do the least damage to the national system, but it would be devastating to a lot of middle-sized cities across the country.
You know, I've thought about it a lot, but I'm not so sure the general public is thinking about it a lot. It's popped up kind of cryptically during the conventions, not so much the Republicans, but definitely the Democratic convention. Why aren't they talking about it more? Why isn't somebody swinging from a vine screaming? If it's so...
I think that's unfortunate. And part of it is I think a lot of people think, well, this is so crazy, it's not going to happen, so I'm not going to worry about it.
Right.
But that sort of pushing it off, the head in the sand approach, I think really makes it more likely that it is going to happen. I think if people had sounded the alarm 6 months ago, then there would be a lot more pressure on Congress to act before they go home. And my concern is if they don't act before they go home for the election, that this is going to get mixed in with a kettle of fish in the lame duck session that's never going to get cooked. So So we're going to be in a situation where a lot of very bad things for the economy will happen in January before the Congress finally gets its act together and undoes it.
Now, Congress, I mean, for all intents and purposes, isn't expected to change much in terms of its makeup at this point.
Right.
So what will they do? Just put it off for a year or pull off something like that? Or what are the options?
Yeah, I think that they're probably going to try to postpone it with some kind of a temporary fix. But all of that is, you know, I mean, when you don't know
right
what you're going to do, if you look at defense contracts, for instance, if the Pentagon has to start renegotiating contracts with in January in order to take money out of them, it's going to make whatever we purchase a lot more expensive. And the government's not going to get a very good deal on future contracts if it can't keep going forward. So an awful lot of damage is going to get done, even if they do fix it, you know, in late January, February, or sometime during the fiscal year. And when they fix it, I think they're likely just to kick the can down the road 9 months or a year. And so we're going to have all of that uncertainty hanging over the economy for an indefinite period of until we finally get a Congress and a White House that can agree on a path forward.
Is that $1.2 trillion in across-the-board spending cuts that would begin in January if this issue is not resolved before then? Is that per year? What's the time frame for that?
It's $109 billion a year.
Okay. Over the course
and
of?
That, yeah. And over the course of 10
years.
Maybe I think it's 9 years,
mm-hmm.
but there's some interest savings that go along with that. But that means in the coming year, about a 9% cut in both defense and non-defense spending. That 9% in the coming year will really feel more like 12% because we're beginning it 3 months into the fiscal year instead of in October when the fiscal year begins. It takes place in January, but 9% has to be taken out of those budgets before September 30th. So it's going to feel more like a 12% cut, and that's just a huge cutback in terms of the number of people doing food safety inspections or approving FDA. Drug trials or administering all of the databases that the FBI maintains now.
Of course, with most big cuts like this everywhere, you know, whether it's your township or your school district or your state, it usually ends up being people who are losing their jobs. That's what
it's all people. Yeah.
Right,
I mean,
it's all people.
Every dollar is going to come out of somebody's salary someplace. So it's going to do that. But in this particular instance, it's much worse than that because there isn't the discretion given to the people that run these programs to try to find the least destructive way to do this in many instances, and so you end up cutting back services that really major sectors of the private economy are dependent upon those services. Meat inspectors, for instance, we have to have meat inspectors in slaughterhouses and packing plants in order for them to operate. We've had that law for over 100 years, and there's a real question if the sequestration takes place, whether we've got enough to staff all of those facilities so that the meat packers and meat producers can function.
Why did they make it non-discretionary?
Well, I think the Congress didn't trust the White House and didn't want to give them the latitude to pick and choose the choices. And you can sort of understand from a political standpoint, they might be nervous about that. But it's just another thing that makes this such a stupid and awkward and destructive piece of legislation.
It also excluded Medicaid and Medicare, right?
For the most part, there is a provision in the first year that affects Medicare reimbursement rates on very specific narrow group of things, but that accounts for only something like 10 billion of the 54 billion in domestic cuts.
We have a tweet from Parker. He writes, if you only have $10, you can't spend 11, but somehow the government doesn't understand that. Is that what's at issue here, Scott Lilly?
No, I heard the Ryan quote at the beginning. I mean, the idea that there's some ceiling on the amount of money the federal government can spend is just not factual. During World War II, we spent over 40% of GDP. We're now spending about 23%. The reason is because we've got so many elderly people in this country now, and that's the reason that it's pushing upward. And I think we really have a decision as to whether we want to continue these programs that provide the current standard of living for our elderly, or do we want to pay a little more in taxes? I agree that we need to get our fiscal house in order, but I don't think it should be focused entirely on spending, and it certainly shouldn't be focused on this narrow group of programs are basically the operating budget of the government. They affect too many other things that people may not recognize right now, but they rely on them pretty heavily every day.
How you mentioned earlier, they might just put this off for another year, but that still is affecting those long-term decisions from the private sector. And you've said that there is not a quote-unquote bright line between the economic activity of the public and private sectors. Is there any line between them at this point in time?
Well, there ain't any question that there are some wasteful government programs and places that we ought to be much more careful and vigilant in terms of watching how the programs perform and whether we're getting our return on it. But a huge portion of the federal budget, and particularly this, two-thirds of what the government spends, it doesn't spend on its own activities. It really goes out and checks to people, mostly through Social Security and Medicare. So when you get down to the other third, the remaining third, which is the operations of the government, half of that is at the Pentagon and the other half is domestic. So you're really talking about the 14 of the 15 departments of the federal government that the non-defense part really only spends about one-sixth of the money. And that's about $600 billion a year, and that's where this $54 billion is taken the first year and for each year, each of the 9 years after that. That's just not a very smart place to take it. There's so many things like airports.
Mm-hmm.
Our economy really operates off of airports. Maintaining our roads and bridges is very important to the economy. Our entire pharmaceutical industry is really built around the research that's come out of the National Institutes of Health, which we spend $30 billion a year on. But I think people that have looked at it think we get a pretty good return on that investment. The government and the economy are closely linked.
Mm-hmm.
In a great many ways, and we need to be respectful of that when we look for places to cut.
Scott Lilly, thanks for joining us today. Appreciate
Glad
it.
Glad to be with you.
Scott Lilly, Senior Fellow at the Center for American Progress. Thanks for listening. This is listener-supported WOSU 89.7 and WOSU HD1 Columbus, and streaming on the web at WOSU.org, 89.7 NPR News, your all-day NPR news station, a service of WOSU Public Media.